Blog Talk Radio.
Brought to you by Satanic International Network. You're listening to the Ooze.
Looks like you got four big dicks in the room, so who's gonna fucking slap this shit down first?
Basically, and then focus on the problem at hand. You're not dealing with the emotion, you're dealing with the issue.
Richard, it's been a big, long-winded speech to all passes up today for you gentlemen, but unfortunately, I'm somewhat bankrupt.
Now onto our show.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm T.C. Downey, a.k.a. Beast Zeno, and this is my co-host, Dark Fool. Dark Fool, how you doing today, man?
Man, I am doing great, man. I am now on winter break. I have got my coffee, and we have got Dan Harms on the line, man. And this is going to be one hell of a show, let me tell you, right off the bat.
Dan, how are you today, man?
I'm great. How are you?
Excellent. A lot of people are actually really interested in who exactly you are. I became familiar with you through previous associations, but I think it'd be great if you could tell them exactly who you are, what you've done, and I guess we'll go from there.
Well, at this time in my life, I'm a librarian and a writer. And I've been doing quite a bit of work on Lovecraft and his mythos, the Necronomicon, modern occultism, games connected with Lovecraft, all of those things. I pretty much, at this point, just kind of dip into projects as they interest me. So I have to say, it's at this point, I'm having a lot of fun in life.
It sounds like it. Now, I'm a huge fan of H.P. Lovecraft myself. Now, I'm not nearly as fanatical as others that I've seen, but I do really enjoy the mythos. I enjoy what seems to be a loose construct in an association with some form of an esoteric understanding, although it's very controversial, I would say, to try to pin any kind of connection to it. I believe that's actually the focus of one of the two books that you've written. Is that correct?
That would be the Necronomicon files, yes.
Yes. All right. And now, before we get going here, I know Dark Fool actually had a question that he wanted to prompt to you, so I'll let you do that real quick, man.
Okay. Just right off the bat, I wanted to know, there's been a lot of, you know, with the Lovecraft mythos coming out and H.P. Lovecraft making a fictional book of the Necronomicon, and of course, many of the listeners out there already know that there are different versions of the Necronomicon, the most famous being the Simon Necronomicon. I wanted to know, one of my main questions for today was, what do you think about the quote-unquote connections that people have made with the Simon Necronomicon and Sumerian mythology? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the Simon Necronomicon is a modern book. It was written in modern times for the most part. I'm going to say for the most part because you really have a lot of prayers and rituals that come from not so much necessarily Sumerian, but from some of the later, you know, Akkadian, Babylonian periods that have been worked into that. So I don't want to say that the Necronomicon is completely a modern book. That's in terms of any sort of esoteric book, you usually run into that, where some parts of it come from some doctrines, some particular rituals come from a much older source, but then it's all brought together and combined with modern material. So I would say there is, you know, if you go in there looking for some things, you'll find them and say, hey, you know, this is like the descent into the underworld of Ishtar or Inanna. That is in the Simon Necronomicon. That's authentic, but it's not, you know, that doesn't mean the whole book comes from the same time period. It's an incorporation of material, sometimes I'd say lifted out of context, and just basically put together by someone who, you know, I won't speak too much to their motivations. I can speculate, but it's not really an ancient book, was what it comes down to, with a few ancient bits here and there.
right. And you've actually done quite an extensive amount of research on this, from my understanding. In particular, I guess you and John Wisdom Gantz III, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Yeah. You guys co-authored, and this is actually kind of reverse of what I intended to do, but you guys co-authored the book, The Necronomicon Files, and I guess it's subtitled The Truth Behind the Legend. Is that correct?
I think the new edition is The Truth Behind Lovecraft's Legend. The publisher wanted to work in Lovecraft in there for sales reasons. And he said, okay.
For sales reasons.
Yeah.
Right. Now, real quick, stepping right back into the way I actually wanted to go, the Cthulhu Mythos Encyclopedia. Now, I've not actually had the opportunity to read either of your books yet. They are on my reading list, but being that I'm authoring my own book at this point, my time and research has to be more directly associated with what I'm working on myself. So
I am right
on the reading list.
Yeah.
Oh man,
yeah.
It looks like all three of us are on the same page, Beast. You know, because I'm writing my book as well, and this certainly is on my reading list, especially because one of my chapters is dealing with Chthonic and dark gods.
Mm-hmm.
So yes,
now
I'm definitely going to catch up as well.
I have read a lot of really great reviews of the Cthulhu Mythos Encyclopedia. I've heard people state that it's an extremely comprehensive look at the different uses of specific entities within the Lovecraft mythos. However, I've also seen some criticism that you leave out certain entities, and I was kind of wondering if you would kind of tell us why.
Well, I'd have to know the specific entity. Can you give me an example? I can talk about, you know, it's easier for me to talk about specific examples, or I can talk about the philosophy of the whole thing.
If I can really quick find, because I'm going basically off of your Amazon reviews, so if I can find if they gave a specific example, I'll definitely bring that up. But I'm assuming that they... something was mentioned about deities that were mentioned only once, not making it into your book.
Well, that would be the case. It wasn't the case with the first edition. With the first edition, I was, you know, there wasn't as much mythos fiction being published. A lot of it was pretty much inaccessible at the time. We were talking about, you know, the early 90s. So there just wasn't a lot of these reprints that had come out, and, you know, people finding old stories and republishing them, people finding new stories. So, you know, I could say, okay, well, I'm just going to put this in because I think it's neat. That was a lot of my philosophy for the first edition. And as time went on, I started to realize that, oh my gosh, if I throw in every name that I find out there in the fiction, this book is going to be immense. If people were trying to buy this book and I did that, no one would be able to buy it. The book would probably be five times longer than it is. And a lot of it would just be a name and, you know, a sentence saying, gray old one, found in this work of fiction, and that would have been it. I mean, it would turn into a multi-volume work. We had to really, with the third edition, which is the most current one, we had to really just push the limits. This book is huge. Something
right.
Like 150,000 words. So
wow.
Yeah, that's where what my response would be to that, because you would have to go into some crazy multi-volume sort of thing that really nobody would use. I mean, after a certain point, you'd just be wading through page after page after page of, you know, creations that no one had ever used before and would never use again. So
yeah,
that's why I did it the way I did it.
Now, that actually
okay.
Leads me to my question really quickly, if I may interject here, Beast. When you're compiling this encyclopedia or your Lovecraft lore, you're taking not only from Lovecraft, but you're also taking from gaming books, you know, Cthulhu D&D,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. Now, how do you find a balance, you know, where to balance between the two? You know, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it does depend on some external factors, such as when I was writing the first and second editions, it was for a gaming company. And so I wanted to make sure to get the gaming in there, because I think that, in a way, the gaming literature is a lot more influential in many cases than a lot of the short stories and other things out there. There's more people buying it. There's more people interested in it. So I wanted to make sure it, you know, that I put all of that in there. For the third edition, I scaled back a bit, just because we were going away from a gaming publisher to a fiction publisher. But I think that it's nonetheless important to keep the focus on Lovecraft. After about the first edition, where it was just like, okay, this is neat, I'm going to put it in, I realized I need to have more of a philosophy behind it. So the philosophy behind the book is that, okay, let's take Lovecraft's The Call of Cthulhu. And then, okay, this Cthulhu's mentioned in this story. Where's Cthulhu mentioned in other stories? Alhazred's mentioned in this story. Where's he mentioned somewhere else? Just kind of to create a web with that as the center and move outward from it. And if that corresponds with something that's in a gaming book or on a piece of fiction, that's great. If it's not, then I'm not going to worry about it. It's kind of a way to also get around the whole problem of what to put in and what not to put in. If you use Lovecraft as kind of the centerpiece, move out to some of the authors around him, and then go move outward from there, you can have a book that is really hitting all the important points, I would hope, but not necessarily becoming tremendous or, you know, focusing too much on material from games or something like that.
Okay, that actually kind of leads into what my question was going to be. I was going to ask what your actual, what you envisioned the use of your Cthulhu Mythos Encyclopedia being. It seems that I'm guessing when you first started writing it, it was for gamers, and then it more became for Lovecraft fanatics, or is it the reverse?
Neither, actually. When I started writing it, it was just of this weird compulsion, because, and out of boredom as well, because I was at the time working fast food in a small town in Kentucky over the summer, and I was just completely bored out of my mind. So I said, okay, well, I'll start, you know, why don't I just start writing some entries here and there about the things I'm reading? So I just start writing them. And I went away to college, and the first semester there, I'm working on a book. Now, this is not a good time to work on a book when you're, you know, you're just getting used to, you know, going to classes and, you know, dealing with the demands of that setting. And after a while, I said, okay, I have 70 pages. I'm going to, you know, send this off to somebody. I'll send it to Chaosium in this case, the gaming company. And they'll probably just look at it and send it back, and that'll be it. I won't have to worry about this anymore. So I did it, got it out there. I was done. I was happy. Everything was good. And then they wrote back and said, you know, we think we could turn this into a book, but we're going to need more material. At which point I then realized that this was going to be a much bigger project. I think one of the flaws of the book is, okay, I was about 19 at the time. So I didn't really have an idea of what the audience could or should be. I just kind of said, okay, well, we should have an article on Cthulhu in there. Let me see what I can find on him. And I would write it up. I would never really think about, you know, what I intended for people to do with it. But what I found is that people find it to be quite useful in terms of, you know, writing mythos fiction, understanding mythos fiction. People use it in their games to say, okay, well, we just found this blasphemous tome. What do we know about it? Oh, here's Dan's book. Why don't you read the entry? Things of that sort. So it actually has been a book that people have found to be very useful.
Absolutely. I do understand it as that. Another thing that I was actually kind of curious about was the length of time that it took you to, from start to finish, to put out the first edition of the book.
The time it took me to put it together, there were a little glimmers here and there, probably when I was in eighth grade. This tells you how long I was working on this book. I started to work on it a little bit then, but I'd have to say it was about a year, on top of taking a full load of classes at university. So it took about a year, I'd say.
Of course, and that was with already having some existing knowledge of the mythos and everything. Anyway,
not as much as I had liked. it was only when I started really putting together the books that I did get to go back and read some of these authors like Block and Clark Ashton Smith and Robert E. Howard. Because, once again, this was in the early 90s. The big Lovecraft glut of the 70s was well and gone. Most of these books were not in print. I mean, we have a really great selection of books that are in print right now with, you know, all of Lovecraft Circle's authors are in print and available. And that just wasn't the case at the time. So I had to do a lot of footwork and track a lot of them down.
Excellent. Now, let me ask you, what do you think about people actually using the mythos to work magic?
It's their business. And it's often very interesting business from an aesthetic standpoint. So I've been impressed with Kenneth Grant's work, though I have to admit I don't understand a lot of Kenneth Grant's work. Been interested in some of the ceremonies Aquino wrote for the satanic rituals. There's a book called Necronomicon Gnosis, and I forget, it's a Scandinavian organization that put that out. And that's been some fascinating reading. So I dip into it from time to time. And I generally like what I see. I don't know how effective it is. I can't really speak to that. But it's interesting.
Okay, so it is something that piques your interest as being a form of use.
Yes, definitely.
Go ahead, B.
I'm sorry, please.
From what I've seen in past shows, Dan, I actually did a little bit of research before doing this show, and you've been a bit of a mythbuster as far as, sharing where, certain pieces of information come from. Have you ever thought of actually starting again and creating your own grimoire based on what you know, just for humor's sake?
I've thought about it from time to time. I think I gave Dave Irmitt's Mysteries a shot at one point, and I also would say I have someone ringing me here. I'm just going to keep talking. I actually did participate in a Necronomicon online version at one point. Wrote up a ritual to Deoloth, the render of the veils from the works of Ramsey Campbell. I've dabbled in it a little bit, but I generally try to steer away from that because I've realized just how seriously people will take even a joke. I used to do joke posts on the old Altor Cthulhu Usenet group. One of them was saying, oh yeah, I happened to find Lovecraft's lost story, Life and Death, which was supposedly published somewhere off in the amateur press, and it never, no one knows where it is. Apparently all the copies are mutilated or just missing. And when I put it out there, I was like, okay, yeah, it's April 1st. Nobody's going to pay attention to it. And then a couple of months later, a French author came back and said, you know what, we're putting together this Lovecraft anthology. We were wondering if we could get a hold of Life and Death, and we want to know where you got it. I'm like, no. At that point, I realized, I can't do this. I can't do this because, people see things, and the power of the written word is so great that people see it, and they latch onto it. This is, I think, what has fascinated me about the mythos, what has frustrated me about the Necronomicon, is that people see something in print, and it's got to be real. And I've had to, I just try to avoid that as much as possible because I just, I don't know where it's going to go. Just as Lovecraft didn't know how people were going to interpret and work from what he wrote about the Necronomicon and turn it into something else.
Right. Now, that actually kind of leads us into our next area of investigation here. But before we get into this, what went into the Necronomicon files, I'm curious, do you actually have some form of esoteric practice that you participate in, or a said religion?
Well, I'll tell you what I've generally told people, which is that I don't talk about this, and here's why. Because if I say, let's say I was Wiccan, and I told everybody, okay, I'm a Wiccan, and now I'm having this opinion on the Necronomicon or something like that, the response would be, well, oh gosh, he's Wiccan. Of course he's not going to like the Necronomicon. Of course he's going to have an agenda here. So I just don't tell people about it because I know how these debates go. It becomes too much of a punching bag. or you know, it's the people go for the easy attacks. That's kind of how it will play out. So what I do is I don't tell people, and then I let them just make up things. And it's really, really a lot of fun to see that. I mean, I have to, you know, give Warlock a hard time here. There have been times when Warlock has said, you know, I was a member of the Caliphate OTO or something like that. I've been accused of being part of a secret organization headed by Donald Tyson to discredit the Simon Necronomicon so he could sell his own Necronomicon, which I have to say, since apparently we inspired Donald Tyson with the Necronomicon files to write his own Necronomicon, that's really twisted there. So I generally just, you know, keep it out. And it's, sometimes people just come up with some really, really funny stuff. And I just, you know, and then you can say, okay, well, you know, this person obviously isn't very serious. Or, you know, this person is just making up things and they're trying to find something. And it becomes real, very obvious when they're trying to do it. It's often
amazing. Well, and also from a practical business aspect, you don't want to limit your readership as well.
Well, it's not so much about worrying about my readership. If I was worried about my readership, I probably wouldn't be writing the things I write about.
Right.
So, I mean, it allows me to participate in the debate, and then you don't get, you know, caught off on some side tangents, you know, like, what do you believe, you know, where do you come from? I'd say, okay, here's my work, here's what I'm saying my work. If you can, you know, if you can engage with that, and you can give an answer, and if you can refute that on the basis of its merit, that's fine. Otherwise, you know, it's kind of a waste of everyone's time.
Right on. Now, real quick, obviously, the Cthulhu mythos is something that's been at least something I want to call a hobby or a passion of yours for a long time. Do you have a favorite character or deity?
Favorite character or deity? It really depends. For example, for a while I was writing a book on ghouls. And I really like ghouls. I read a lot of stuff about ghouls. Now I just hate them. I don't want to see them anymore. I'm ghouled out in a sense. So, yeah, it can vary over time. The ones I feel particular resonance with, I would probably have to say the King in Yellow is a big one. So I've gone back and read Chambers and Bierce and all those people, read the various editions of the King in Yellow that have been out there. And that really is one that really speaks to me in a sense, because it's, you know, it's about decadence, it's about, decay, it's about corruption. And it's very interesting how people have put that one together. And I think that really speaks to the strength of the mythos overall, which is that you could have all these different sort of tropes and all these moods and things like that, and they all come together in this one big umbrella. And I think that's really, really nice. I mean, Lovecraft did not confine himself to a genre. He was not a genre author. He wrote science fiction, he wrote horror, he wrote fantasy, or what we call them these days. And there's just so many things you can go around and take looks at. And sometimes it just depends on a project. I just got done with writing a gaming scenario drawing from Fritz Lieber's Our Lady of Darkness. And I got back into that Reddit, and I remembered again, you know, how strong that was and how much resonance there was with, you know, how we live today, what it's like living in cities and, you know, where you don't know a lot of people, and the mystical possibilities thereof, and the, you know, and so it varies over time, I'd have to say, overall, in terms of which one I resonate with at the moment.
Right.
And
but
speaking
overall,
speaking of favorites.
Don't like deep ones, I'll say that.
Speaking of favorites, there have been a lot of films that have kind of touched on the Cthulhu mythos. Have you come across any films that you think does the mythos some justice?
Some justice. Well, that's a very good question. I do like The Call of Cthulhu that was put out by the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. That was excellent. The special effects could have been better. I understand why they weren't, because they were trying to get for the feel of a movie of that time. But I think that was probably the best of the lot. The others are generally very bad. Some of them benefit from the fact that sometimes Lovecraft was very bad in stories like Herbert West or The Lurking Fear. And so adaptations of those, they don't tend to go as badly just because they weren't starting out with much to begin with. But overall, I haven't been too impressed with most of the movies I've seen. There was one by Aaron Vanek called The Yellow Sign. I saw a screening copy of it, and I don't think it is ever released. That one was also pretty good. That was more of a Chambers movie than a Lovecraft movie.
Excellent. All right. Now, the Necronomicon files, that's, I would say, probably the highest acclaimed book of yours out of the two that have been released at this point. This just, of course, obviously my observation from the commentaries left and the amount of interest that seems to be generated to each book. What was the intent going into making this book?
The intent going into the Necronomicon files was a little different from my perspective and John's perspective. John had actually run into a small group of people who were practicing magic from the Simon Necronomicon, and it was a very sort of destructive sort of religious relationship, let's say, for the people involved. It was very controlling and had, very disturbing as to what was going on. So he started to get interested in the Necronomicon, the Simon Necronomicon itself, which led him to Lovecraft. And what he decided to do is, okay, I'm going to write a book on this, but I don't know Lovecraft very well, so I'm going to need somebody who can work on this. So I did a ritual. He did a ritual to find somebody who knew something about Lovecraft. And he was hanging out at our campus radio station one night, and then I walked in. And for my part, I started treating it as kind of an interesting intellectual exercise. Like, okay, well, I know the Necronomicon's fake, but let's see what's out there about it. Let's see what we can find. How many editions have come out? How have they been received? How do they reflect Lovecraft? So I treated it in that sense. But it eventually came together, and I started to realize, like, oh my gosh, there are actually people who do believe in this. And I think that's a common response from people who come from a science fiction horror sort of background as I did. At least back in the day before the internet was so prevalent and you could just find things online. So I started to see, okay, well, there seem to be people who take this very seriously. Sometimes people who use the book do not use it in a responsible manner. And if someone's beliefs, which could be, have this destructive aspect to them, I don't want to say everybody who's in the Necronomicon has destructive beliefs by any means, but if people are getting into trouble because people are exploiting them with the Necronomicon, so let's have a book that says, hey, this isn't real. And if people read our book and they decide that they don't want to pursue that belief system anymore, then probably they shouldn't have been pursuing it to begin with. So my motivations with the Necronomicon files changed over time. I could say I'm still happy I wrote the book. I think most of the book stands up. Some people have criticized the tone that we've used in the book. I think the people talk about the tone, they talk about the content, as is often the case.
It sounds like a good counterbalance.
Mm-hmm. We thought it was good also to have that out there as, we're starting, as the web got big in about 1995 as we're writing this, and people start to say, people are starting to see more and more editions, they're finding out about them, people are marketing them. And just being able to hit the market at that point and say, wait a minute, you should read this book. It'll tell you what's going on here.
Okay, a couple of things. Could you tell us a little bit about the content of the book? Is it a strict comparison? between the Necronomicon itself, the Simon Necronomicon, and other Necronomicons? Is it a comparison with ancient history?
Well, there's a discussion of a number of different topics. We start out with Lovecraft, because that's really where the myth started. So we talk about Lovecraft, we talk about, you know, what his influences were, talk a little bit about whether Lovecraft himself was an occultist. He wasn't. Or whether he was familiar with occult doctrines, which, and that's a little bit more ambiguous, but I think the answer is not very. And then we move on to the various Necronomicons that came out. Now, we weren't able to do a detailed side-by-side comparison with, of the Simon Necronomicon with some of the texts that are out there, largely because I don't think Avon would like that very much. But we did try to illuminate, okay, this is where he's getting this particular concept, this is where he's getting this concept, and also dipping into the Mesopotamian literature about, you know, witchcraft and things like that, and the scholarship that's been done on it, and being able to say, okay, this is what Simon says is going on, this is what the scholarly literature says what's going on, and being able to compare them, and being able to say, you know, this is our understanding about these civilizations, and Simon's books have diverged over time. Whereas if you would say that Simon's book was a real Mesopotamian grimoire of sorts, you'd expect people to start saying, okay, well, I found this over here and this over here, and, you know, this validates it. But it's really gone off in two different directions. We also touch on things such as the Necronomicon in the movies, and I think John had a lot of fun watching those movies and tracking them down. Some of them are, if you read the book, you know, are really just horrendous. I mean, if you think you've seen bad Lovecraftian cinema, you have no idea yet. Just some of the really horrible things that are out there. And as he's, and he made me watch some of them, so I'm well aware of it. But it's, we want to try to get the whole phenomenon of the book. I think the only thing we neglected was a chapter on the Necronomicon in Cthulhu Mythos Fiction. I put together that chapter, but then they said, okay, that's, the book's big enough as it is. And I think I don't know if I still have that up on the web someplace. I did have it up at one point. But the idea was just to get the whole Necronomicon phenomenon encapsulated in one place, at least, you know, for what was going on at that time.
Now, how many Necronomicons are you aware of being in existence?
At least a dozen. And that's when I wrote the book originally. Yeah, I think there's probably several more that have come out. There's Warlock Asylums. There's Josh Free's Necronomicon. There's Donald Tyson's Necronomicon, which, as I said, we inadvertently inspired because we asked him to write the introduction to the book, and he just got so intrigued in the topic that he decided he was going to write his own. So, unfortunately, we may be responsible for that, but it's a fun book. Not exactly what I was intending to have happen, but it's, you know, it's, once again, getting back to what I said about the written word, you sometimes don't know where what you write is going to go and how people are going to take it, what they're going to do with it. So it's there's so many out there, and the number is growing all the time, because people just are find this to be an incredibly intriguing concept, and they want to be a part of it. So it's surprising, because I have a friend who just, on one feverish afternoon, composed, you know, his own Necronomicon, and now people are saying, well, that's the equivalent of a plutonium. You know, don't go anywhere near it. And it's just amazing, you know, how these things have transformed, and they'll continue to transform.
Absolutely. Now, I'm curious. My understanding is that Lovecraft never actually put out any type of a Necronomicon. I believe we can establish that as being full fact, yes?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So what's interesting to me, then, is the way that I've understood the Necronomicon in my reading of Lovecraft was that it was kind of a personal grimoire that was taken over from the other side and materialized here. Would you categorize that as being a correct understanding?
In terms of Lovecraft, I don't know if I, I mean, in the sense of being a revealed book, yes, I would. It's kind of, Lovecraft often is very vague about it. And it does change between his stories. Sometimes it's just a history of the prehistoric world. Sometimes it's a grimoire. Sometimes it's a book of mystical warnings. It just, you know, he used it for different purposes throughout his fiction. But it does seem to be about, you know, things that go beyond the world we know and the realms we know.
Interesting. I'm sorry for bouncing around. I've just got so many questions, and I'm trying to think of what's going to be most relevant and then get the best sound bites here. One curiosity that I have, and apparently somebody else in the chat room does, is have you actually spoken with Peter Lavenda?
I have never spoken with Peter Lavenda. We exchanged emails probably back in 1997. You asked him a few questions about the Necronomicon, and he was kind enough to respond. I spoke with Simon for a little bit on Coast to Coast AM. I don't know whether that probably counts as speaking with Peter Lavenda, but I haven't had, you know, the opportunity to sit down and really talk to him at any point, and I don't know if I ever will. I don't know if he wants to get into that situation. It would be, I think it would be an interesting experience. I'd love to, but I don't know whether it will ever actually happen.
All right. Now, there actually is a caller that has been calling in since the beginning of the show, on and off. Would you be happy to take calls, or?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so let me go ahead and put them on the air. Caller?
Hello?
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hello. How are you?
Hey, how are you? Is this Dan?
Yeah.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. Is this Warlock?
This is Warlock Asylum.
Excellent. Good to hear from you.
Hey, how's everything going?
Everything's going great.
Yeah, I just wanted to give you a buzz up for a second. How you doing, Beast?
I'm doing excellent. I'm enjoying the guest.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, Hans is a phenomenal person with the Zulu Encyclopedia. It's very good work, you know. So I was wondering, did you have any more works coming up in the future? I know we email sometime, but I didn't have any really chance to ask when I was listening to the show. I thought I might ask in reference to going in depth into the Lovecraftian lore, something similar to that nature. Like
going in depth into Lovecraftian lore. At this point, I don't have any plans along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
We have a number of very good Lovecraft scholars who are coming in now. Lovecraft is finally getting some recognition, and I think those people are doing doing some very good work. For my part, I've largely turned to the Grimoire tradition, actually. So it was a little unusual because... Yes?
Okay.
Everything okay? Okay.
Okay.
Donald Tyson went into the Necronomicon from the Necronomicon files, and I went to the Grimoires.
Okay.
And then, so that's what my current focus is on. I'm working with books like The Long Lost Friend and some Elizabethan Manual of Spirit Magic, which we hope to publish at some point. So that's the direction I'm going right now.
Oh, okay.
I get back into Lovecraft from time to time, but it's not, you know, I might get back into it later, but, you know, nothing really that I'm planning right now to talk about in that regard.
Yeah. Because it seems like, when I was listening to some of the conversation, even about the Necronomicon material, it seems like, you know, I know a lot of people may come to you for reasons of trying to understand a little bit of, let me say, what will be a commentary maybe on some of the stories and review. And I know you have like the encyclopedia with the identification of the characters, but what may have been like in the psychology of the stories that were written? You know, so I don't know if there's anything that will work as far as that was concerned or whatever.
There's people who are doing good work with that, and they're probably doing better work than I could. in terms of, like, looking at, you know, what are the themes behind it? Because Lovecraft, I think, I've come to understand, and I think this is one of the reasons why he's so resonant with so many people in the occult realm, is that he has that ability to kind of, I wouldn't, don't know if it's a explicit tapping into that realm, I would probably say not, but he gets that there are currents there, in a sense. And he uses those currents, that, you know, not necessarily in the sense of the cultists would, but in the sense of creating entertainment.
Right.
So he,
right.
But he does meet those, that sort of, you know, what you want to call the collective unconscious, perhaps. He gets he understands that, and he's able to he was able to, you know, grasp onto it.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is. I was thinking earlier today, too, a little bit about that in retrospect, even to some satanic thought, where it's like sometimes Benjamin Franklin's perceived as a de facto statement, similar in a way like Lovecraft is perceived as a de facto, I guess, a cultist, for whatever reason, to his fiction, you know. So it's interesting, but that's all I have today. I think I'm pretty much done with the debate, you know, on that whole deal. But it's just good to hear from you, and you're doing pretty good things and stuff, you know.
Well, it's good to talk to you.
Yeah, same thing. I'll catch you later. Okay. All right. Take care.
You too.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Okay. Thanks, Lee. I'll catch you later.
Talk to you later, man.
Okay. All right.
All right. Moving on here. Dan, actually, when I first contacted you, I had intended originally to do a show focusing on authenticating ancient texts, you know, what might have to go into it to, you know, distinguish between primary sources and secondary sources and so forth and so on. I'm kind of curious as to your feedback on that.
Well, I can talk a little bit about the Necronomicon and how I've looked at that. I also want to say that I'm not an expert in this field by any means, because there are people who do this for a living. I start as an amateur. I pretty much remained an amateur at it for a while. There's, you know, it's a bit more professional, but there are people who are, you know, much better at me at this. But in terms of looking at a book like the Necronomicon and saying, okay, is this an ancient book? Is it a modern book? I would once again refer back to what I was saying before about how these texts often span a considerable amount of time in terms of what the material is within. And if you want to know whether that where that text dates, it's always important to concentrate on, you know, what are the tells that this is, you know, the most modern. Because otherwise, if you start saying, okay, well, this part of the Necronomicon comes from 5,000, 6,000 years ago, that really, it's interesting, but it doesn't really tell you the origin of that text. So you start with that and saying, okay, I'm going to start looking for the more recent material. You know, is there something that reflects, in the case of the Simon Necronomicon, Crowley or, you know, pagan belief or something like that, modern pagan belief? And that's what I was looking for. Also of interest in that particular regard was to say, okay, on one hand, here's what the Necronomicon says. What is the current scholarship saying? Do the two converge? Do they diverge? And just being able to compare it to other sources.
Okay.
So, and that's how I went about it.
Can you guys
it
hear
also,
me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't know. Yeah. Continue.
It also helps to be able to have a large number of examples there for you to refer to. I think that's one of the important things that's going on with occultism right now is that there's now an amazing amount of material in print. So you can go back and say, okay, well, you know, what do Sumerian poems look like? What do Sumerian hymns look like? What's in the Necronomicon? How does that fit together? And there's also a little bit of mental flexibility involved. The ability to say, okay, I think this is true, but maybe it's not. Why don't I take the opposite view and argue that for a while? And being able to go through and say, okay, this is how what people who see this book would interpret as ancient, and this is why they think that. And if you can do that and then you turn it back around and say, okay, well, what's the argument against that? That can often help quite a bit. I also think it's a shame that a lot of people don't use all of the tools that they have available to them to learn about ancient cultures. because there's just so much out there. There's this unbelievable amount of material. I've never really gotten back into the Mesopotamian material because that's a, what I call another lifetime, along with things like, you know, studying Clark Ashton Smith or alchemy or all those things. That's another lifetime. I'm going to have to get back to that then. But there's just so much that's been published on these areas, and it's amazing. And some people just say, well, I went out on Google, I did my search, and this is good enough. Well, sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. And I think I would encourage people who are interested in topics like this to get out there and see what they can track down, because there's quite a bit. And I want to turn quickly to the subject of hoaxes. Hoaxes are tricky because most of us are not equipped to deal with any sort of deception. Think of all the media messages and text and communications that come across your desk every day. I mean, just hundreds of different sources. And the ability to focus on one of them and look at them is, you have to actually take some time out of your day to make sure you do that. So they're often very difficult to handle. And they're especially difficult to handle because there's another person on the other end who's trying to deceive you. So I get into arguments with people about the Necronomicon, and they say, well, if this was really a fake book, wouldn't they do this? Why wouldn't they put Abiola Hazard's name at the end of the Simon book? And I say, well, maybe they anticipated you thinking about that, and the author decided to do something else. And so, that sort of thinking, which we often try to get into and try to figure out motivations, doesn't work so well with hoaxers, because if you can come up with something that would make it look authentic, they can come up with something that makes it look authentic. And there's also the verisimilitude of the whole thing, where if you take some things that are true and some things that are false and you stick them all together, then you get something that's much more convincing than if something that was, say the Simon Necronomicon was called the Necronomicon and just had with all Lovecraft, no one would have this debate because everyone would say, okay, yeah, this derives from Lovecraft. But the fact that there are elements of other traditions in there makes people say, well, some of this actually looks like it's old. So in a sense, it's using these different techniques, understanding that you're dealing with that sort of deception, possibly, and then saying, okay, well, what can I find? Can I find other sources? Can I move beyond this debate and start looking around and see what I can find and whether it validates what's here? And it's often a very time-consuming and difficult task, and I understand why people don't want to do it. In fact, that's one of the main reasons why we wrote the Necronomicon files, because nobody should have to go through what we went through, especially some of those movies. Those were awful.
Right. Now, how long did it take you to actually compress the Necronomicon files?
Oh, let's see, the Necronomicon files, that would probably be, I think that was another year. With, we kind of went with stops and starts, and one of the great things about working with a co-author is that after a while, you get a few months down the road and say, I haven't heard anything about this for a while, and you go and, the other person is, at kind of stuck someplace, and then you get them unstuck and keep moving. So I'd say probably another year. And I have to say that was really a great process. It was very a surprising process. I think that sometimes when people say, well, Dan was debunking the Necronomicon, he's going to go in and he's not going to find anything new. We found plenty of stuff that was new and very interesting, especially with regard to, for example, we got this Lovecraft quote about Crowley, massive psychological putrescence, he called him. And I was genuinely surprised to find it. I had no idea that Lovecraft knew about Crowley. But, we were finding things like that, and I think that really, those were some really great moments when we start to realize, okay, well, things aren't quite what we thought they were, but we'll tell people about them and let them, read the book and figure out things for themselves.
So was it more important to come to some kind of a conclusion at the end of it, or just to kind of present all the evidence that you had found and allow your reader to make his own determination?
Well, for my part, I didn't see those two as, you know, mutually exclusive goals. First of all, we did want to come to some sort of conclusion, because otherwise sometimes people look at, you know, the massive information out there and they don't know what to think of it. They, you know, people I've found with the Necronomicon tend to read into it what they want to read. Very few people are going to say, you know, well, Dan Harm says this, so it must be true. So we wanted to make sure we gave our perspective on it, that yes, we went back and looked at things, and it was a hoax, in our opinion. But we also wanted to present as much material as possible, so that, you know, people will say, well, okay, you're saying that, but can you prove it? And we went through and we documented as much as possible about it. Just, you know, we have a list in the footnotes of the complete occult contents of Lovecraft's library. It's not very impressive, but we've got it in there so that people can't say, well, you know, what was Lovecraft reading? You know, maybe he read these books. And the great thing about Lovecraft is his life is so well documented. The man wrote 15 to 20 letters a day, and then, you know, me might write fiction too, or some poetry or something like that. So there is just so much information about him, and we know so much about what he believed, what he thought, what he was eating, you know, what clothes he was wearing, his positions on political issues, just, you know, this amazing amount of data that we have on him. And we wanted to make sure people had as much of that as possible. Because, I mean, at the time, once again, Lovecraft was well-known, but he wasn't as well-known as he is now. So, you know, being able to go back to, say, selected letters and pull out quotes and put them to where in a place where a reader could find them without having to track down, you know, some book that's been out of print for 2 decades. So that both parts were essential to what we were doing.
Now, Dan, I have another question for you. With all of this information gathering, what would you say, like in your own personal experience with all of this data, what was the most painstakingly difficult issue or topic to deal with when trying to make sense out of all of this?
The most difficult topic. That's tough. I mean, a lot of it was really just being able to track down sources. There's still some unresolved issues in the Necronomicon files. For example, I would love to speak to Steve Chapo. Now, if you don't know who he is, Steve Chapo was one of the two monks who supposedly stole the Simon Necronomicon from some collection someplace and then made it available to Simon. So, you know, that would be something. I spent a lot of time trying to track him down, was never able to do it, even with, you know, people who, you know, I had knew a guy for a while who was in a collection agency and who tracked people down for a living, could not find this guy. So, there were some things like that that were just, you know, very, very difficult to get past. Finding the Necronomicon spellbook itself was nearly impossible. It hadn't been reprinted after the initial run. It was very rare. You didn't have a lot of internet booksellers. That took so much time because, as I will say, this is putting my librarian hat, so many of these books on occultism get stolen from libraries, and it's really a shame because there's a lot of, you know, interesting information people could get, but they tend to walk off. So I remember getting the spellbook, which, you know, now you can go into Barnes & Noble and buy for $5.99, and having to go to special collections where they said, okay, you know, you can't use any pens, you have to sit at this little table with this little paperback book, and just, you know, you get to use it here. You don't get to do anything else with it. I mean, it was just, things have changed so much now in terms of how much information is available to us and how much easy it is to get.
And when in doubt, there's Wikipedia.
Yeah, there is Wikipedia. Wikipedia, I think people have often overlooked as a way of, you know, just shaping information. What it was like back in the day when you had, when we had like the Encyclopedia Britannica when I was little, when we got 30 volumes, and I was so happy with that. And now it's just you look up things online for the most part. It's gotten a lot easier, and I hope people who are practitioners of occult paths should, appreciate that, especially the younger ones, because I remember even 20 years ago, what it was like tracking down some of these books, and it was nearly impossible. And it's, I think that's, you know, I think the Necronomicon files would be a lot easier to write today, because people are, you know, there's just so much availability.
We've only got a few minutes left here, and you got one more caller, if you don't mind taking them.
Sure.
All right, I'm trying to get him on the line. Here we go. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, am I on the air?
Yes.
Yes.
Hi, thanks. This is Nagashiva. I think you may know me as Tiagi also.
Oh, hi.
Hi there. I had a couple questions. I really appreciate your work, and I've collected your books and things. You have a couple of titles out there, and I wasn't sure about the difference. One of them is Encyclopedia Cthulhiana, and the other is the Cthulhu Mythos Encyclopedia. Are they different?
They are different. The first two are the Encyclopedia Cthulhiana. That's first and second edition. The first edition I probably wouldn't even go for. The second is a lot more complete. It contains a timeline of the Cthulhu mythos. And so that one's pretty good. The third one is the most recent one. I would also say that's probably, in my opinion, superior. But it doesn't have some of the things the other one does. Because as I went through, I said, okay, well, I don't need this, or I should put this back in. So both, all of them are kind of works in progress. But I would say I'd probably go for the third one at this point.
Okay. And do you have a favorite Necronomicon?
Favorite Necronomicon? I really like Tyson's. And the reason I like Tyson's is because Tyson, and he told me this, he set out to write the Necronomicon that Lovecraft would have liked to see, being completely faithful to Lovecraft, not bringing in Sumerian gods or, you know, all these other issues. Or, you know, parts of other pantheons, or, you know, trying to ascribe it, as I think the Hay people did to John Dee, and bringing, you know, a bunch of, you know, trying to cast in the realm of ceremonial magic. Not that there's, you know, anything particularly wrong with that, but it's more interesting to see someone taking Lovecraft and saying, okay, this is what I'm working from. And now I want to see what I get out of that. And that, you know, that was always the intriguing part for me with his work.
I have one more question before I go, and that is, what do you think of the works of S.T. Joshi?
S.T. Joshi's works are wonderful.
Yeah.
I can't recommend them highly enough. He does have his particular opinions on things, but he's one of those authors who will say, okay, here's my opinion on this. Here's what the facts are. Here's what my opinion is. And then you can go from there. I mean, he's very good about that. He doesn't, you know, try to, you know, give you just like part of the view or fit, try to give you facts that fit the view. He goes, you know, he'll say this is what Lovecraft said on this issue, but I think he was being a little ridiculous at that point. So he's done a lot of work. He's done a lot of really good work. He's just released a 2-volume biography of Lovecraft, which I have not seen. But I'm sure it's absolutely wonderful. So I would highly encourage everyone, if you want to know about Lovecraft, pick up S.T. Joshi's works.
Thank you very much. I'm going to listen on the air.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, with just about a minute left, I want to tell everybody who is listening that you can find links to both of Dan Harm's books out right now, as well as his WordPress site, in the description of the show page. Dan, is there anything you'd like to plug?
Well, just keep an eye on the blog, because that's where I tend to announce various projects. We are looking at getting The Long Lost Friend published somewhere. I'm not quite sure where at this point. That's the Pennsylvania German grimoire of folk magic. And I'm also working on a book of Elizabethan spirit magic, which I think is going to be really interesting. I think there's an invocation of Satan in it. So that could be of interest to some of your listeners. So just keep an eye on the blog, and I'll let you know when things are coming out.
Excellent. And now I have a feeling we're going to go over just a little bit, which is okay, because anybody listening can always come back and archive. But I really quick just wanted to ask, since you brought up Old Scratch, I was curious to know what your thoughts were on the modern Satanism movement.
I think that the, well, let me think, what can I say in a short period of time? I met a lot of cool people in the modern Satanism movement. I don't necessarily agree with the doctrines, but I think I've come to an informed opinion about that. I mean, I've read my way through LaVey, including The Complete Witch, oddly enough, read Aquino's work, read Don Webb's work, Kenneth Grant. I every so often I dip in to kind of get an idea of what's going on. And there's a lot of very sincere, very intelligent people in there who are doing some very interesting work. Is that good enough?
That's excellent. Yes, that's absolutely excellent. And then I was just really quickly wanted to thank you very much for giving us a great show. I actually have an idea for a future project that I'd like to maybe keep in contact with you about, if you're good with that.
Oh, sure.
All right, and that's it, man. I mean, thank you very much. You gave us a great show. It's been a while since we've been able to run over time, so that's excellent.
Excellent.
Yeah,
thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, too, that, I mean, it has been great being the co-host on the show and having you on, and I know how much of a fan Beast is. I myself am, you know, just getting my feet wet with the whole Lovecraftian mythos, and it was hard for me to find a balance to, you know, ask questions, because I know how much of a fan Beast is, so I let him, you know, ask away. But I also wanted to thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
All right, and with all that being said, we'll talk to everybody next week.
Okay, see you guys later.
All right, thank you, Dan.
You're welcome.